when Zeus had intercourse with her. And Diotima says, yes, that's exactly right. So, because the gods cannot have direct intercourse with humans or converse with humans, an intermediate realm of beings had to be created. And we call these intermediate beings daimons. They fly upward with our prayers to Olympus, and they fly downward into Hades, and they deliver the messages very much like Hermes Mercurius. Many of you know that Hermes Mercurius is the patron saint of depth psychology, precisely because he goes both ways. He's a daimonic figure. He goes up with his wing sandals, and he also couldn't go down and bargain in the underworld with Lucifer to release Persephone for 6 months of the year. So it's also from Hermes that we get the word hermeneutic, which is part of our quest for meaning, for the meaning of these entities. So that is an interesting way of thinking about the powers, is it not? Psycho-spiritual powers, they're personified in human form, but they're also of divine origin. So they have this dual destiny, and they are kind of an internal transitional space. They fly and descend in an internal, I like to think of them, you know, as the demons and angels that go up and down the ladder of the ego self axis. They're an internal transitional space. What's that? Can I go back one? Absolutely. There's the bright angel. And I gave you an example of her at the gate of dissociation. Here she is helping dissociate the child. And here's the other angel. So, okay, now, once you get into the gates of Dis, it gets pretty horrifying. So those of you who have weak stomachs, you might want to close your eyes. Actually not, these are not that bad. Here are the specters of, I forget which particular group of sins, rising from the grave. Pardon? Who did this picture? This is, oh gosh, I don't have the provenance of this one. I'm very sorry. It's not Dore, I don't think. Doesn't look like Dore. These pictures all come from a book. If you're interested in really seeing this iconography beautifully, it's a book by Charles Taylor and Patricia Finley called Images of the Journey in Dante's Divine Comedy. What they've done is collected all the art, or a lot of the best art, that's been done over the last 700 years since the writing of the poem. And it's inspired artists from, you know, all kinds of different quarters that have done this. Now it's coming out with Dan Brown's book. But artists from all periods since that time, the Renaissance in particular, have been very involved. Here is, this is Gattuso. This is the first ring of Circle 7. The violent against others are now immersed in a river of blood. Everywhere there's splitting, dismemberment. They're being punished for their own crimes. Here is Rico Lebrun's decapitated sinner holding his own head. Here's another image of the splitting from Blake. So finally, the two of them end up on the Cocytus River, the river of mourning, the fourth great infernal river. And here the heads of sinners are frozen into the ice, and now they're very close to encountering the main demon at the center of all this unremembered suffering. And here's Dante exclaims, I thought I saw a shadowy mass appear, then shrank behind my leader. I stood, with fear I ride it, where at last the shades, quite covered by frozen sheet, gleamed through the ice like straws in crystal glass, And when we had come so far that it seemed right to my dear master that he should let me see that creature fairest once of the sons of light, he moved him from before myself, halted, and said, "Behold now this. Behold the place where thou must steel thyself with constancy." How cold I grew, how faint with fearfulness, says Dante. Ask me not, reader, I shall not waste breath telling what words are powerless to express. This was not life, and yet it was not death. So eternal suffering was not life, yet it was not death. It went on and on and on. So on their journey, the poets have now one final task. They must clamber down the hairy body of Dis until passing down through the hair of this awful stench, this body, they descend through the netherworld until they have reached the navel. Some say the groin. Dan Brown says the navel. And I think he's probably researched it more than I have, but Taylor and Finley say the groin. But at that point, the whole armature of the poem turns 180 degrees. Now down is up. And the poet and his guide now find themselves crawling up the hairy legs of Dis toward the opening of purgatory. Guess where? On the other side of the earth, in the southern hemisphere, where they come out under the starry vault of the night sky. Here are the legs of Dis. They've climbed out. Now they're under the night sky. This is Dante's, what is it? What is he saying here? Or how might we think about this? Well, this is the moment when everything changes, right? You've gone down to the very deepest place of despair. It's like Lenihan in that chapel. Everything's over. There's nothing to hope for. And at that moment, often, if we really can allow that pain and suffering to be present and just hold it, the whole armature of everything will shift. And the way out will be apparent.
Could I say something there?
You certainly can.
That's really dark. It also seems to me that what changes everything is the cry for help. I admit I can do nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
Help.
That's right. Thank you for that, Patty. Patty's written a wonderful book, for those of you who don't know it, on taming your inner tyrant. And this imagery is all about the inner tyrant. And the cry for help is a turning it over, a surrendering of what? The story about your pain. The victim-perpetrator story about your pain. As Gangaji says in this wonderful clip, which is, tell me again, open, unprotected, and free, is there's a big difference between just the pain that you have to turn into, which is I hurt, and the story about your pain, which is what you have to surrender. Because Lenihan had tried and tried, and everybody had tried to help her, to help herself, to get out of this terrible pain. At the moment of complete surrender, something changes. It's like the whole armature changes and you see the other world. Now, what's the difference between the suffering in the inferno and the suffering in purgatory? This is really important. We'll talk about this a little bit before we end and then have some questions. It's not eternal, and it's been volunteered for. The people in agony and purgatory have repented. They have given it up. They have surrendered. And they have had a true I can't help this. Please help me. I'm at the end of my wits here. I need help desperately. I cannot do this anymore. And their suffering is suffering towards something. It's what Jung and Freud would call meaningful suffering. Suffering towards liberation, towards release, and towards a fuller life, towards a rejoining of life. Because the story that we've had so far is a huge interruption of life. So it's a story about rejoining life. I want to just tell you something. Oh, before we... That's right. That's true. There's no motivating light at the end of the tunnel. You've had your vision. You know now that there's stars up there in the sky that you can again experience. You can get out.
If someone wants to ask a question or make a statement, please raise your hand, wait for Dr. Kalshet to recognize you, and wait for the mic so we can all hear your comments and appreciate them.
Thank you, Steve. We're going to stop in a moment, and we'll have some time for questions on, I promise. I'm getting tired of listening to my own voice. You'll be interested in another recent description of dis comes from a contemporary writer named Eckhart Tolle. Tolle has brilliantly described the dark angel as the residue of accumulated childhood pain that becomes lodged in the mind and body as a negative energy field called, he says, the pain body. Here's what he says about the pain body. If you look at the pain body as an invisible entity in its own right, you are getting quite close to the truth. It has two modes of being, dormant and active. A pain body may be dormant 90% of the time. In a deeply unhappy person, though, it may be active 100% of the time. Some pain bodies are obnoxious but relatively harmless. Others are vicious and destructive monsters, true demons. Some are physically violent. Many more are emotionally violent. Some will attack people around you or close to you, while others may attack you, their host. Thoughts and feelings you have about your life then become deeply negative and self-destructive. Illnesses and accidents are often created in this way. Some pain bodies drive their host to suicide. The pain body, he says, and this is really very interesting, wants to survive just like any other entity in existence. This dark angel wants to survive like any other entity. It takes on a life of its own. But it can only survive if it gets you to unconsciously identify with it. It can then rise up, take you over, become you, and live through you. It needs to get its food through you. It will feed on any experience that resonates with its own kind of energy. Anything that creates further pain in whatever form, anger, destructiveness, hatred, grief, emotional drama, violence, even illness. So the pain body, when it has taken you over, will create a situation in your life that reflects back its own energy frequency so it can get food. Pain can only feed on pain. Once the pain body has taken you over, you want more pain. You become a victim or a perpetrator. You want to inflict pain or you want to suffer pain or both. Now, in this passage, Tolle suggests that dis gets his energy through seducing the ego into identification, into believing the truth of his negative interpretations of reality. These negative interpretations represent stories that explain suffering in terms of an innocent victim, evil perpetrator scenario. And the more this reality becomes accepted as real, the more depressed and shame-ridden the inner child in the trauma survivor becomes. In this sense, dis is like a vampire feeding on the host's lifeblood, having no life energy of its own. The resulting depressing fact is a true Faustian pact with the devil. Now, I want to just conclude here with some comments from Helen Luke's wonderful little essay. This is in a book called The Way of Woman, called Suffering. Let's see. Here's what she says about the transformation when this poem turns and they end up walking up into purgatory. Because Helen Luke has done a lot with Dante. She's written a book called In a Dark Wood, or there's something White Rose in it, or Dark Wood, White Rose, I think. Quote, when we experience at this moment, what we experience at this moment is a total transformation of the nature of the darkness itself, or rather our attitude towards it. As long as we seek to escape from our various hells into the freedom from pain, we remain irremediably bound. We can emerge from the pains of hell in only one way, by accepting another kind of suffering, the suffering which is purging instead of meaningless damnation. The souls in the Purgatorio suffer the same kind of torments as those in the Inferno, but they suffer with the willing acceptance instead of with bitter resentment. And then this comment. True suffering belongs to innocence, not guilt. Deeply ingrained in the infantile psyche is the conscious or unconscious assumption that the cure for depression is to replace it with pleasant, happy feelings. Whereas the only valid cure for any depression lies in the acceptance of real suffering. Yeah, I will repeat that because it's so important. True suffering belongs to innocence, not guilt. Deeply ingrained in the infantile psyche is the conscious or unconscious assumption that the cure for depression is to replace it with pleasant, happy feelings, whereas the only valid cure for depression lies in the acceptance of the, she would say, of the deeper pain underneath the story of suffering. I just want to quote her a couple more times and then we'll stop. The minute we accept objectively the guilt and the shame, like my patient who accepted the self-loathing that had so operated in her, the innocent parts of us start to suffer. Those childlike parts that we've encapsulated, kept away. Then the weight that we have been bearing in the story of suffering becomes a sword. We bleed, and the energy flows back into us on a deeper and more conscious level. Moreover, there is always an implicit universal meaning, even in the carrying of small miseries. Every time a person exchanges neurotic suffering, depression, for real pain, he or she is sharing to some small degree in the carrying of the suffering of mankind, in bearing a tiny part of the darkness of the world. Now, this is so important. Every time a person exchanges neurotic depression for real suffering, he or she is sharing to some small degree in the carrying of the suffering of mankind, in bearing a tiny part of the darkness of the world. Such a one is released from his many small personal concerns into a larger sense of meaning. Thus, the smallest act may have an influence, as the Chinese sage puts it, at a distance of thousands of miles. At a distance of thousands of miles.